I'm going to call the Jobs Committee to order. We have, well, depends on how many questions. We either have a full or a very short agenda here today. But before we get started, I have two things. We have the meeting in St. Cloud on Friday. So if it leaves, the bus leaves, or we have a bus, the bus leaves at 10 a.m. from in front of the SOB. Please contact or have your L.A. contact Travis. We're going to leave like at 10. We should get there about, well, it's going to snow, or it's supposed to snow on Friday, so we're leaving a little early. There's a place to get some lunch prior to the 1 o'clock hearing, and then the bus will take us all back here once that hearing is over. So please contact Travis. The other thing,
what time are we expected to be back?
I'm going to say 4 o'clock-ish, depending on the traffic and the snow. The other thing is we have 37 bonding bills at the current time. Many of us have bills in this list of bonding bills. If we are to hear, there's two options here. We can hear all of the bonding bills, or I can just sign them off by memo off to the Capital Investment Committee. But then you don't get a chance to show off your oratory skills in committee. It's more likely than not we would keep them relatively short, the presentations, and 5 to 10, 7 minutes. I think the bonding committee gave somebody 7 minutes to do one. I thought that was pretty good. Me. But it very well might precipitate an evening meeting, which will not be on Wednesday. We don't want to interfere with the caucuses, the relative caucuses. Please catch up with me today or tomorrow to kind of give me some feedback. It's an easy decision for me to make, but I want to hear what the committee has to say. So we've got the bus taken care of, got the bonding bill taken care of. Let's see, Representative Gunter, it looks like you got the minutes in hand there. Would you like care to move the minutes?
Chairman, I'd be glad to. Thank you very much.
Any additions or corrections, subtractions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of passing the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We have the minutes are passed. We have Deed here to explain the governor's budget and add any comments that they are allowed to add. So please identify yourself. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair.
Looking forward to it. I went over your presentation last night, your budget the day before. I'm all geared. I'm all ready to go. So why don't you identify yourself for the tape and please proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Grove. I'm the Commissioner of DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It's an honor to be here today. I'm excited to dive into this budget. I think the last time I was here, we were just getting to know each other. It was my third day on the job. We're a month in now, and now we got lots to talk about with the governor's budget out last week. I'm really looking forward to hearing your feedback. I'm going to walk through this about 30 minutes or so, and then we'd love to take questions at the end on all that we're going to go through. I want to say just at the outset, if this is my first time working with all of you in a legislative session, I'm excited to collaborate with you. I think this is a great chance for us to work together. I want to stress collaboration over ownership. These ideas are starting points, and I think refining them and making them even better with your input is really the top of my priority list. Second, I really want to just bring a lot of candor to this conversation and not spin. Let's talk about the specifics. Let's talk about what we want to get done and just cut to the chase. And then last, I'd say I bring a sense of urgency and optimism to this. I think we face a lot of big challenges in the state as it relates to jobs and our economy, and I think we can't afford not to be focused on what the top priorities are in the coming years for the state's economy. And I know that those topics are up for debate and ones that we should debate with a lot of thoughtfulness, and I'm excited to hear your feedback and ideas. So I'm, of course, going to review the parts of the governor's budget that relate to DEED, but just to sort of remind you of what you probably saw last week as the governor rolled out his budget, there are three broad categories that he's defined the budget in, education, health care, and community prosperity. Most of the deed budget is in that third bucket, although you'll see pieces of deeds budget proposals sprinkled throughout all three, and of course, they're all connected as it relates to how our workforce can grow and develop, and our economy can grow and develop over time here in Minnesota. So those are the broad categories of the governor's budget. These are the pieces of the budget that are relevant to this committee that I'm going to review today. We're going to talk about community prosperity grants. We're going to talk about a new idea called the Minnesota Innovation Collaborative. We'll talk about the Angel Tax Credit. We'll talk about family and medical leave insurance, which is a placeholder in the governor's budget. We'll talk about Opportunity Gap Grant Programs. This was formerly known as the Equity Grants. Excited to talk about that as well. We'll talk about child care. There's a nonprofit assistance program that we'll go into. We'll talk about VRS. And then lastly, we have a few kind of minor policy changes to JCF and the MIF policy that I want to just highlight for you so you're aware of them. They're not really budget items, but they're policy changes that are designed to make those programs run a little bit more smoothly. So let's dive in. First up is community prosperity grants. And this is an idea that I think came from the governor's time on the campaign in particularly smaller towns in the state, and particularly towns that are quite small, 5,000 people and under. And the core insight here is that these smaller towns need help. They need help to grow and prosper in today's economy, and they need flexibility to use funding for what they believe are the most important economic development projects in their towns. And so these are grants that would be focused on those small towns. They would be organized to be matching grants with local government sources of funding as well. And they are, again, targeted at giving some flexibility to local towns to do economic development in the smallest towns in the state. You know, I think we want Minnesota to be a model of a state where you don't got to move to a metro to succeed or to grow in your economy. And so this grant program focuses on that piece of the economy. The next idea is the Minnesota Innovation Collaborative. This is a new idea that we brought together to try to galvanize all of the thinking and ideas in the marketplace today on how to grow our startup and innovation economy. This is a part of our economy that is critical to grow. For every new job created in an innovation sector job, five new jobs are created around it. So it has the strongest network effect of any job sector, and the innovation sector does. And just to be clear on what the innovation sector is, it's not just tech. It's any sector that is trying a new solution that relates to a new set of jobs and a new set of economic development outcomes. And so this program seeks to tackle that ecosystem more broadly. The Angel Tax Credit is a separate piece of legislation from it, but we see the Angel Tax Credit as part of this broader collaborative that we've defined. Comes to the idea that the startup ecosystem is critical to this state, that the startups we have today are the huge businesses of tomorrow. We really need to expand our efforts in this space. You know, Minnesota, as we talked about last time I was here, was once really the center of the nation's tech economy, and now we're 17th, 18th. We're certainly not even in the top 10 as it relates to tech economy growth. And so we really want to put our foot on the pedal in this space at this key inflection point in our economy as we transition to an innovation and knowledge economy from manufacturing and agriculture. So the Minnesota Innovation Collaborative has sort of three buckets. The first is a set of incentives focused on giving startups the opportunity to start and grow and thrive. One of the bigger factors you see in the startup ecosystem in the state today is that there's some risk aversion in Minnesota around the startup ecosystem. You hear this from everybody in venture capital to the startup community that you talk with. It's almost sort of like the downside of having a great Fortune 500 economy is there's lots of jobs and stability in stable environments, and the incentive to start something is a little lower than you might hope that it would be. And so these incentive programs focus on that. The second bucket is education. This is focused on how to help people figure out how to actually start a company. The process of putting together a venture pitch deck or building out a team or growing a technology effort is daunting to a lot of people, particularly if you're from disadvantaged communities who might not otherwise have that kind of mentorship or leadership in your circles. Having the education opportunities to get started is critical. And then the last piece is outreach, and this is about making sure that all these efforts reach across the state, and that we can have the state government play a key leadership role in galvanizing the community in the Twin Cities and in the state more broadly, which is sort of a more disparate ecosystem as it currently exists. So I'll dive into each of those pillars in more detail. The first, again, is that incentive piece. We have about $5.8 million set aside for that part of the initiative. I should say the whole collaborative is $9 million, $4.5 and $4.5. It's a biennial ask. And there's some programs here that are, again, focused on the incentives for entrepreneurs. The first is a series of research and development grants that would give commercially viable projects one-time awards of up to $50,000 to develop the research needed to create their startup idea. The second is a series of business liquidity grants. This really gets into sort of the how of putting your business together, whether it's office space or staffing contracts or sort of business liquidity needs to get your startup off the ground. The third is entrepreneur benefits package. You talk to the startup community, they love this one because one of the challenges in leaving a stable job to start a company is that you don't have health insurance or the benefits that you would sort of need to feel stable for you and your family. And so we have set aside in this package about $1 million to give really small one-time awards, about $7,500 to people who are starting a company to help them have the health benefits needed to take that risk again to start a company. The fourth is small business innovation research match funding. This banks off of a federal program that helps startups take advantage of research RFPs from large federal organizations who are looking to solve vexing problems. We would match some of that funding here in Minnesota to accelerate our startups focus on those problems over other states. It gives them a leg up. So this is about $500,000 each year with grants of up to $50,000. And then the last is an innovation voucher program that really focuses on giving startups access to capital to try out their ideas using facilities or research or technical assistance from universities or other research institutions. So let's say you're a science startup, but you don't have a spectrometer in your garage, but you got to use spectrometer time to test out your idea. These types of vouchers would give you access to some of that technology to accelerate your development process and build your business a lot more quickly. So that's the first pillar. That's sort of some incentives around the space. The second is really focused on education. This is, again, a recognition that to start a company is a daunting process. Knowing how to create a pitch deck, raise money, create a technical team is challenging. And so these are a series of grants that would enable nonprofits and sometimes private businesses to provide these educational opportunities to Minnesotans across the state. Mentorship, one-on-one consultation, classes, what have you. I think this is a sort of ecosystem effort at education. Consider this sort of the workforce development piece of this idea. And then last is outreach. And this is really about creating a sort of an office with Indeed focused on this community. We've got all sorts of offices with Indeed that focus on communities that we want to grow. But we don't really have one focused on startups and on the innovation economy. And I think the way to do that isn't by just creating another office, you know, three doors down from mine to tackle this, but really to put this effort out in the community. So to find some space inside of a co-working space, perhaps at the U or a university, we'd have to figure out where, that would create kind of a focal point for the state's effort, a kind of front door for it, that would, of course, have some staff, probably I think like an executive director and a couple of staff to run it, and a mandate to outreach into the community and all the programs I just mentioned, and work with key leaders across the state to make sure that these efforts land and that we're serving the most people against a strong set of metrics for success. So, again, this broader umbrella is saying, look, this budget will be the biggest effort that this state has ever taken to jumpstart our innovation economy at a time when that economy is critical to states' growth across the nation. When you look at Texas and Massachusetts and California, you know, their leadership in this space is not an accident. They invested. Their governments got involved. Their research institutions got involved. They worked hard, and they put money up to put a flag in the ground and say, we're going to be a state for innovation, for startups, and for growth. And we see this Minnesota Innovation Collaborative as the first step for Minnesota to do more there. Again, the Angel Tax Credit, which I'll talk about in a moment, would be sort of part of this package. And it's, again, a separate piece of legislation because it currently exists, and it has its own law to manage, but we see that as all part of this broader package. So this is a new one. I'm taking a little bit more time on it because it's new to all of us here, and we'll answer questions on it in a moment, but we're excited about it. We think, again, getting back to that sense of urgency and optimism, this is one of the pieces that if we're doing right by the citizens of the state to focus on the areas of the economy that are most important, we have to invest here. And this is just a start. I would love your ideas. I know a lot of you speak with entrepreneurs in your districts and have thoughts on this, so would love to get your feedback on how to better refine this over time. In that same breath, let's talk about the Angel Tax Credit. You've heard legislation on this already. Members of this committee are deeply involved in this space. We were, of course, once an innovator with the Angel Tax Credit. We practically invented it back in 2010, where we were one of the first states to create this program. Since then, 29 states have followed our lead and created their own programs. Last session, this program lapsed. That's an unfortunate thing. We need to bring it back. And, of course, DEA isn't the only one advocating for this. There's all kinds of advocates for it. But, you know, this led to, in its first iteration, over $421 million in private investment in Minnesota startups, $101 million in tax credits to these angel investors. I was talking with our Deputy of Economic Development, Kevin McKinnon, the other day. He told me that year over year, more and more of that money came from outside the state. In fact, last year, the last year that this program was enacted, 51% of the venture capital that came in through this program came from outside Minnesota. That's huge. That's showing the rest of the country Minnesota's a place to invest. It's not just a sort of navel-gazing, let's invest in each other and give ourselves kickback kind of program. This is bringing in new money from outside the state and putting Minnesota on a map that in a way we should be proud of. And so we're excited about that trend. We want to lean into that trend. We were leader in this space, and unfortunately we let it go last year. We need to bring it back. Rather than just bring it back in its cold form, one of the advantages, I suppose, the silver linings to having it lapse and bringing it back is we can re-examine certain pieces of it that we want to make better for our state. And so we thought a lot about the equity gap and the gap and the things that made this program challenging for both entrepreneurs in greater Minnesota, but also entrepreneurs from underserved communities. And so we have a few new policy elements to the program this cycle that we're excited to include in the budget. The first is that there is, I think, a very wise stipulation in the current proposal that says that startup founders need to pay their employees a certain amount of money. That's, I think the members of this committee were integral in creating that stipulation. It's critical. In greater Minnesota, it's a little bit harder to meet those employee compensation levels. And so we talked to lots of entrepreneurs out there who weren't able to get the credit based on that stipulation. So we've shifted that to say if 51% of your employees make the minimum wage requirement that we've represented, I think it's like $20 an hour, roughly, then you're eligible for the credit. So we want to get more greater Minnesota startups involved, but to do that, you have to make a few tweaks to make sure that they're eligible. And then second, for targeted businesses, and again, this is both greater Minnesota but also underserved communities in the metro, we have lowered the investment thresholds. It used to be you had to invest at least $10,000. Based on feedback we've had from 5 or 6 years of this program, we've lowered that to $7,500. And so we want to make it easier to invest in those businesses. And then the last piece is more of a technical thing, but we found that the annual reporting on this could use some work, and so we want to shift the incentives there to incentivize stronger annual reporting so that we can get the best data possible to make the program even better. So excited about this one. You know, the members of this committee who've been on it for a while are well familiar with it. The governor's talked about this ever since the campaign trail. We're willing to push it forward and, again, make it part of that broader Minnesota Innovation Collaborative effort that will be such a big opportunity for us all. So that's sort of the innovation and entrepreneurship section of the budget, and I'm excited to circle back on that in a moment. Next, I'd like to talk about family and medical leave. This is a big idea, as we all know, and it would put us in a real leadership position as a state compared to others across the country as it relates to taking care of workers and protecting workers when they need that help the most, which is when either they have had a child or they have a family member or their own sort of health incident. This plan would seek to help them and protect them and give them the benefits to take time with their family and take time to take care of their health when they need it. About 1 in 10 Minnesotans every year have to take some kind of a leave for a medical reason, so this isn't just for a few people. This is a lot of people have this issue. And, of course, the Federal Family Medical Leave Act allows you to do that, but you don't get paid. And that means particularly if you're a low-income worker, that's hard. In fact, in some ways, basically impossible. And so the protections are there with the Federal Act, but the compensation isn't there with a state plan not in existence. And so California has done this, New Jersey has done this, Washington has done this. Some of these programs are sort of in process. Others have results to share. New Jersey in particular has some great studies on about how their program has rolled so far. I think interestingly for this committee, the business owners in New Jersey who spoke about this program overwhelmingly said it was an attractive policy and offering for workers and it didn't inhibit business. I think that's a big question we've got to ask. Is the committee focused on jobs? Is this going to slow down job growth? Is this going to hurt companies? And I think we need to make sure that this policy doesn't. So we're excited about this. You know, we haven't yet put a price tag on what this overall would cost. It would be based on a payroll tax, sort of similar to the UI system, separate but similar. So a payroll tax that would be shared by both the employee and the employer, creating an insurance pool that would then allow workers across the state to take advantage of those benefits. Again, that's important because if you're at a big company, then you can access your company's program most likely, because a lot of big companies have this kind of program. If you're a small business, you can't afford to pay somebody for 6-8 weeks while they take care of their child because you're a smaller company. And so this broader pool gets at that issue of how to help smaller businesses alongside the bigger guys as well. We set aside $68 million for this budget item, and that's just for program administration. So we've gone deeply into the analysis of what it would take to create a platform for this and hire staff to administer the program in that first year to process and prepare the benefits. It's, I think, in the high 50s in terms of the number of staff we would need. Thankfully, we have a UI insurance program, so we have really great sort of comparative programmatic metrics to look at to make these calculations. We did think about, oh, could we just sort of lop this onto the UI team, and they could do this as well. That's not going to work. UI is obviously a federal program. This is a state program, and the expertise required to get this right is unique and differentiated. We talked to leaders from other states. That was the sort of the unanimous sense of how to handle this. So $68 million is the amount that it would take to start this. And it's a placeholder that I think as we work this legislation through committees, we'll get a cleaner sense of what it would cost Minnesotans, both in terms of the percentage payroll tax we would need and the overall cost. But eventually, this pays for itself, right? We wouldn't be coming back with more budget asks in the future because the payroll tax would fund it, but you got to sort of start it up. So that's the $68 million to get it going. I'm sure everyone in this room has a story of a time when they've needed to take leave from work and where pay would have been helpful. I myself had twins 2 years ago, and my wife, we both were lucky to work for companies that had paid family leave. It was a godsend for us. I sort of can't imagine life without it, but so many people live life without it. And so we see this as both sort of a moral issue, but also really a business issue. And I'd say lastly that, you know, the talent gap in the state is real. And if we can create the types of jobs and type of policy that make it attractive to work here, that make it, oh, if you move to Minnesota, you have this opportunity to work for great companies, you know, amazing state with a lot of growth. But also, if you have a kid or you have an incident in your life that's challenging, you can take time. Like, these are the kinds of things we want to use to differentiate Minnesota as an economy that talent wants to come to. And so we see it as both part of that talent gap solution as well. Next, I'd like to talk about opportunity gap. This is, many in this room who were familiar with Governor Dayton's equity grants will see this as a continuation of that. We want to sort of change the framing on this and change the framework a little bit, so we're calling this closing the opportunity gap rather than a continuation of equity grants. I think in part because we really want to focus on the opportunities that these programs present to their participants. Everyone here knows the sort of appalling disparities we face in our workforce today between whites and people of color. We're, in fact, the second worst state in the country for this. We should all, of course, be embarrassed about that, and I think we've got to do more to tackle that issue. I should say there are things across the governor's budget to tackle this. This is just one piece of it, but I think it is an important piece. And so we want to hone in on doubling down on organizations we think are doing the best work to close those gaps between whites and people of color. And we've set aside a certain number of organizations from the previous cycle that we're doing that work effectively, and we want to continue their work in the space in this biennium. I think we're looking to pay for this both with general fund dollars and workforce development and the workforce development fund. I know that's a topic of debate. We should discuss it, but just to give you that sense of our funding strategy here, that's how we've teed it up. There's some direct appropriations here. There's also a competitive grant program within this space that is focused on youth at work. We think that focusing on the youth market for workforce development in this space is critical given the longstanding challenges and the importance of the pipeline effect here. So we've really honed in on the youth at work piece of it. And then there's some additional funding here for better metrics and reporting and performance measurement to ensure that these grants actually are being used effectively and, you know, that the organizations that receive them have the capacity as well to manage that money. And I think there's we want to be good stewards of our taxpayers' money, of course, and ensure that our target grantees have what they need to succeed with this funding. So that's a piece of that as well. Child care, I'll just be brief here. I think this is obviously a workforce development issue. If you can't put your kids somewhere you trust, how can you go to work? And so we piloted a program previously at about $1 million that helps new entrepreneurs start child care businesses. Many communities in Greater Minnesota, there's no child care at all in your small town. How do you go to work if there's not a single place that's that you can put your kid when you're at work in your small town? And so this program seeks to advance a successful pilot. We think it'll create about 2,500 new child care slots across the state. It essentially gives some grant and loan funding to get these child care businesses started. And, you know, the pilot's been successful, so we want to double down there. And we think that, again, this is only a couple $1 million with some matching funding. Actually, I think it's only $1 million with some matching funding, but it'll lead to, we think, up to 20 new projects across the state for child care This is, of course, part of a broader child care strategy in the governor's budget, but since this piece is about new child care businesses, it lives within Deed, which is why I'm talking about it to you today. Next, we have a program that's specifically focused on empowering nonprofits to do more effective work. One of the things that you realize when you come into Deed is we work with hundreds of nonprofits across the state, and they all have amazing intentions and incredible talents. They also have limited staff and limited budget. So how do you be successful as a nonprofit in this state focused on workforce if you don't have the right sort of back office support and infrastructure and logistical expertise to execute across your objectives? And so there's a great organization out there called Propel, and they work with nonprofits in the state to provide that back office support, provide that logistical support, to sort of come in and give nonprofits that layer of empowerment that helps them do what they do best, which is understand their communities and craft solutions that will help them succeed. And so this is a piece of the budget focused on that we're excited about. Next, VRS, Vocational Rehabilitation Services. This focuses on the workers among us who have disabilities and who we want to get back into the workforce or help them advance in the workforce based on our services and counseling. We service about 17,000 individuals every year of the biennium, and we get about 7,000 new members of the program every year. There are four categories of disability that we focus on, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Category 1 means you have 3 or more disabilities, and so that's the category we prioritize. There are matching federal funds at play here, so our ask is for $8 million, but just so this committee knows, if we don't get at least $7 million, we will incur a federal penalty for not having continued on in the maintenance of effort of our current program for the disabled, and so $7 million is kind of the floor. The reason we went with 8 is that we did some calculations to figure out what it would do to keep Category 1 open for the entire biennium, and $8 million is where we landed on that. And so this is something we should debate and discuss as your preferences and strategies allow as well, but I think we want to make sure we can definitely keep Category 1 open, that we can continue to get those federal matching funds. And again, this is where government should do what government does best, which is take care of those who need some extra help and who have a ton of abilities but need a little bit of a jump start to get back into the economy. The last two pieces, as I mentioned at the top, are just brief policy changes, so I'll be short here because they're not a budget ask. But we have a technical change to the Job Creation Fund that will ensure consistency with some of the statutory changes made in the last session. So we need to make a shift to the MIF to enable local funds, when they receive money back from our loan fund, to be able to use it in more flexible ways. This was the intention of the 2017 session, but there was some language in the bill that didn't allow for that. Happy to go into that in more detail if you want, but if this is a really minor thing. And then we have job creations on the same page. So with the Job Creation Fund policy change, this one, let me just, it's so minor I need to look it up myself. 1 second. So this one is a technical change that will modify the statute. So there were some changes made to help the Job Creation Fund. And again, the Job Creation Fund is this fund where we actually pay for jobs. So like we fund a business, but they only get the money if they create X number of jobs that they've committed to creating. So that's the Job Creation Fund. And then this is to revise the law to better align with the 2017 provision in the last session to really focus on greater Minnesota and businesses owned by minorities and women. And so there was a revision in the law that didn't circle that loop totally that we're coming back to fix. So again, more detail on that if you have questions, but I'll stop there because I would love to hear your questions and thoughts and ideas. Again, this is a starting point. Really excited to hear where you all land on these things and just thrilled to get to work with you on this. Lots of big ideas and important stuff to get done. Thank you.
Members, we have Commerce after this, so we'll put them through a little torture of about a half an hour's worth of questions, see where we get. If we run out of time, somebody from Deed will come and answer your questions in your office. Without question, I'm sure, correct?
Absolutely. Be thrilled to, Chairman.
So, are there any questions for Deed and the Commissioner? All right. You're in trouble now. I went over this last night. So, on your Community Prosper Grant Program, you have grants would provide 85% of the total project cost with 15% matching funds. Are you planning on requiring any cities that have leftover or Deed loan money that comes back to them to use that as part of that 15%?
That's a good question. I don't believe so. I think that the thinking here is...
Good.
You think we should? Okay. Tell me more about that, Chairman.
Well, in the past, as Deed has made loans... depending on what you want to call it, from which program, they get a certain percent. When it's paid back, it comes back to the city.
Yep.
So if you're going to give them an 85% grant and they have $30,000 sitting in that loan fund that they feel that they can't use for anything else, maybe a sewer or water system, I'm starting to get letters because of last year's legislation.
Got it.
Saying what they're using it for. Well, it's money for economic development. And maybe somebody might say water systems are, but that's not what the intent was. It's to create jobs, new jobs in a old community or a community. So I would prefer to see money that our committee has worked really, really hard, because we're kind of down low on the totem pole, like, oh, yeah, you guys do whatever you want, but, you know, only going to get so much. Be used for what it's supposed to be.
Got it. Chairman, I think that's great feedback. And, look, the idea behind the matching, of course, is to get local investment. And so if that investment comes from a locked-up source of deed funding, then I think we'd be open to that. So,
yeah. I can go on here. Let's see. Which one? With your Minnesota Innovation Collaborative, are you running new programs, or are you reaching out to the current overabundance of nonprofits that say they know how to tell businesses to start up and run? Because I believe we have quite a few that
do
it in this state. We are the land of 10,000 nonprofits,
we are.
Someone told me.
We are, yeah. And I think, I think it's a great question. And we would want to leverage community resources to do these sorts of, for the education piece, to do these sorts of trainings. But I think that we would want an advisory board, and this is written up in the law as we've developed it, of professionals in the community to make the selection of which nonprofits to go with. And so it wouldn't just be Dee deciding sort of who to work with and who not to work with. I think having some business leaders, some startup leaders, some entrepreneurs on an advisory board that would make selections of which nonprofits to work with would be great. I think we would do want to hire, if we hired two or three staff for this, we would want to hire people who have experience in the field and could do this work themselves. But obviously you can't scale across the state unless you work with nonprofits and if you work with the best nonprofits. And that includes universities as well. And so, you know, we want to leverage the wisdom of the community to choose the right organizations to make sure that these programs really stuck. And there's a good number out there, but they could use a lot of acceleration. This is one of the number one things that the venture capitalists tell me is needed in this ecosystem, is that increase in education. So we're excited about it.
We've started with a few other questions. You know, once somebody starts in this committee, it just snowballs. But I have one other question. You mentioned other states that have really invested in kind of the high-tech startup area, California, Texas, Massachusetts. Minnesota is pretty miserly. What do those states spend?
What do they spend in
Minnesota?
Yeah. I don't have an exact dollar amount, though. I would love to do that analysis and be happy to get back with you the exact dollar amount. I can tell you the kinds of things they've done, though. In Massachusetts, starting in 1978, they started putting money from their state investment fund directly into venture capital funds to help increase the amount of venture money available there. Now, we haven't suggested that in this budget. That could be an idea we debate in the future, or if you want to debate it now, happy to discuss it as well. But I do think you sort of got to put your money where your mouth is, and they have put their money into these venture funds, and they've gotten a return on it. And they took a long term view. This is 1978, and you look today at where all the venture money is going, it's Boston, New York, and San Francisco. So they made big investments there. I think in California there's a unique melding pot of factors that led to Silicon Valley's growth. A big part of it was defense contractors there who took deep advantage of the internet and software space. You've got some great educational institutions that have grown. I think that having strong research institutions in the state is critical, and I think we didn't talk about it specifically, but I think partnering with you to really increase their technology commercialization efforts and what they do to really turn their students' ideas into startups and deliver their research facilities is critical. You see that in Austin, where Texas has really taken advantage of the University of Texas there. And, you know, a lot of states, you look even to a state like Pittsburgh, which you think of as sort of, you know, you think of the Pittsburgh Steelers, right? But look at Carnegie Mellon and the influence that institution has had on the market and the things they've done to really make that state and that city in particular a thriving hub for startups. So these things don't really happen by accident. They do take involvement of the state. Now, it's not like the government is going to be the only factor in jump-starting a startup ecosystem, but we need to be a player at the table, and we're not right now. And, you know, I guess one final example would be Chicago, where you see the state government there put up about $9 million bucks early. Happens to be the same amount we're talking about, but we didn't use that number because of it, but it's the amount. To start a center called 1871, it refers to the year the fires happened, right? 1871, when the cow kicked over the bucket or whatever it was that led to that fire. Chicago, of course, had a chance to rebuild after that moment, and so they've used that phrase to kind of talk about rebuilding their economy around tech. They put together this big center at the Mercantile Mart in downtown Chicago. Fortune 500s have their innovation labs there. The state has accelerator programs there. They've deeply invested in getting things started. They've then since pulled back as it's gotten up and started. So I think one thing to say here is we don't want the government to be the crutch of a startup ecosystem into eternity. This is part of sort of galvanizing at this unique moment of time and then looking for ways to transfer some of these things to the community. Ultimately, the private sector will do this stuff best. But when you look at the communities that have succeeded, it's because the government has had a seat at the table. And so that's the impetus behind this idea.
I wonder if the committee has enough in its travel budget to go see that particular one, because I've actually been down there.
Have you?
I haven't walked in there. I was just on a tourist visa, so to speak.
For Chicago?
In Chicago. And I took the train down. Wonderful way to get to Chicago, by the way. I had like first-class accommodations for less than coach money, and I got to go through all down the river. So, but, yes, it was just a hub of, like, a beehive of activity going in and out of there stuff. So
yeah.
I'm going to stop for now. I do want to know kind of a comparison of what Minnesota spends versus these innovation giants.
Great.
Because California, Massachusetts, and Texas, the last time I looked, by the way, Texas was spending $200 million a year. $200 million a year when we were spending less than 20. So, Representative Gunther, if I haven't covered enough.
Well, you can say that Minnesota and Iowa both have more money to spend than we do in Minnesota. We did do that research one time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we talk about state investment funds that have been expended. Let's say we're out of them, mm-hmm. and yet we have this community that wants to have some investment funds to get an industry in there, and the iron is hot and we got to get going right now. And yet they have in their portfolio money that they now think is theirs. It's not for economic development all of a sudden. It's theirs. We can't spend this money. We turned around and said, okay, we will pay for half. You pay for half out of your money. And it worked very fine. So to let them have that money forever is truly a mistake, and we got to make sure they all know what it's for. It's really important. I don't mind giving them the money and let them put it in their investment account. But when ours is depleted, they should have to use theirs. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, thank you for the comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. A number of questions, maybe not all connected, but in each area. So first, the community prosperity grants. I appreciate wanting to support small towns in rural Minnesota. Just a thought. Sometimes a town can be too small to collaborate on the scope of the idea that's really going to make an impact. So I guess I encourage more of a regional perspective, particularly, I think, in southeastern Minnesota. The region has a lot of the same issues. And with the advancement of what's going on in Rochester with Destination Medical Center, the smaller towns around it galvanize around housing and daycare and economic initiatives. And so maybe regionally can have a bigger gain for our buck than just saying a town of 5,000. And I find it's particularly impactful when you talk about the benefit of research institutions. And so towns that don't have academic institutions that have that background mm-hmm. close to them sometimes also don't get the leverage that a larger community gets. So maybe some connections can be made there. Gets more of a comment than a question.
Yeah, no, it's a great comment.
On to the Innovation Collaborative. I'm really excited about that piece of your proposal. And when you talk, this may be what you already asked, Mr. Chair, but just to clarify, when you talk about nonprofits, I'm a big believer in the convener. You know, who is the person that brings the investors, the training, the education together for the small entrepreneur? So is that what you're saying, that in addition to money to the actual entrepreneur, is there going to be money in that proposal that goes to the convener and sort of the knowledge incubator person that can spread it?
Absolutely. Chairman, Representative, I think that the idea here is to find every nonprofit and educational institution organization that's doing great training in this space and empower them to do more, and to empower people who wouldn't otherwise be able to access that training the ability to get there. And so the incentives pillar, the three pillars of sort of incentives, education, and outreach, the incentives pillar is about helping the individual entrepreneur with, you know, health benefits, business equity, research and development, what have you. But the education pillar is about empowering nonprofits across the state to provide more and better training to would-be entrepreneurs that are here. And again, it's everything from a startup 101 deck to how to pitch a venture capitalist to how to create an org chart. The beauty of entrepreneurship is it comes from people having great ideas that start in the idea phase and then need to sort of be operationalized. And that, some sort of idea to execution, is that big leap that's tough. And so you need help. You need support. And so we do think working with nonprofits and educational institutions will help there. And there are some good ones in the state. And I think if this money comes through, there will be even better ones and better capacity. And so you're right. It is all about that convening function to make sure we can bring entrepreneurs together with these nonprofits' help.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. One last question.
And then we'll come back if we have time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a different subject, I'm curious if your proposal for paid family leave, does that mirror the House File 5 that's currently working its way through the legislative process? Does the governor's proposal match up with that, or is it different?
We are looking to work with the authors of House File 5, Representative Halverson, and the advocates and business community through that bill to ensure that it lands in a place that works for business and works for workers. So we are not at this time putting forth a bill from the governor's office on the proposal. We want to work with the advocates, and that's why it's a placeholder for now. We've done the due diligence of figuring out what it would cost operationally to get started from with Indeed. But ultimately, we need to go through these committee processes. In fact, I think I'm in the GovOps committee in an hour or so to talk about this, to ensure that we're scoping the benefits appropriately, that so much such that it will work, and that it will work for business and for the community.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, kind of follow up on Representative Haley, I had a question on your placeholder for the family and medical leave. Can you kind of clarify, you'd stated that the tax will eventually pay for itself. Can you clarify for that for me?
Sure. So it's a payroll tax. That's the X percent of your paycheck every month. And a portion would be paid. I mean, I think this is the thinking of the author, right? I'm just reflecting Representative Halverson in the thinking here. But a portion would be paid by the employer and a portion would be paid by the employee. So it's a sort of a joint partnership between you and you and the company that you work for, and that money would go into an insurance pool, similar to how unemployment insurance works. And then, members of the people that qualify throughout the state would be able to access the benefits when they need to. So it's, in terms of paying for itself, that's the idea, is that ultimately it's a program that would be paid for through that payroll tax.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for clarifying that tax. What is your confidence level? We've got another kind of nightmare in the MnLARS program, Minute, I'm not sure. I don't even think we have a commissioner appointed yet. What is your confidence level that we're even able to create a new program to oversee and administer this new payroll tax?
High, because it has to be. I mean, in order for this to work, we have to create a great technology platform, and I think you've heard the governor from the start saying we're going to own this issue with Minute, we're going to tackle it. He's got money in his budget to do that. You know, we at Deed have a platform with unemployment insurance that we have is one of the best in the country, and so we're proud of that, and we've learned from it. I'm not going to tell you that we won't have challenges, but this will be a priority. I think if we let technology get in the way of every challenge we want to solve in the state, we'll sort of be handcuffed. And so this is a huge priority for the state, a huge priority for the governor. I know Minute's working hard at in fixing MnLARS and other challenges with our systems here, but we got to get it right, and we've scoped the amount of money it would take, and have learned from our other programs, and are excited to build it.
If I could just interject, I have just one quick question. Having come from Silicon Valley, a chief technology officer of a company that employed 30,000 plus employees, would that person make $150,000, or would that person make a whole lot more?
Sir, it's a good question. One of the challenges in attracting talent into government is that the salaries aren't what you would hope for in the technology industry. So, of course, you got to plan other factors, like a sense of purpose and a sense of excitement to help. I will say, just anecdotally, talking to friends that work in technology here in the state, as we've begun to think about how to fix the situation with Minlars a minute, I've had a lot of goodwill and a good excitement from people who want to contribute. And as you probably saw a few weeks ago, the governor announced a Blue Ribbon Commission bringing together several leaders, both private and public sector, to tackle this. And so I think we've got to own the problem. It's a crisis the state needs to fix. I'm glad you asked the question. I think we need to
off right here, because basically what you're saying is that it would take a whole lot more money to get somebody to do a 30,000 employee. So that's fine. I don't want to cut off my members. So you had one more question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your the point.
Bluntness?
The point that you made is a good one and valid. I was just kind of curious, what kind of time frame does the commissioner think it would take to develop and implement this program, and why wouldn't we maybe use private market solutions that some people are currently using already?
Well, I think we need to look at Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we need to look at the right build process. It'll take probably a year or two. As the way the legislation is written, it wouldn't kick in until, I think, 2021. Is that right, Darielle? So 2022 is going to be fully functioning, so we need to kick in the sort of payroll tax acceptance by 2021, so we'd have a couple of years to build it. And we need to look at all available, solutions there. But, I think we need to get this right, and we don't want technology to be a barrier to us tackling big ideas, and that's been a priority of this administration, and it will be a deed as well.
Representative Zong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you for recognizing the racial disparities in our state. As you know, I'm carrying one of the UI bills for deed, and I'm just curious as to some of the concerns that were raised by Legal Aid and Take Action, Isaiah. They had sent you a letter a couple of weeks ago, if you had a chance to respond to that. And what is your commitment to access for unemployment insurance for low-income families? How are you going to address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's a great question. I did receive that letter, and I think we have a meeting on the calendar. If not, we're finding one now. So I don't really want to comment on it yet, but I do want to sit down with the group and hear their concerns and learn ways that D can do better.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, I would really appreciate if we can have a conversation and get going on it, because it becomes lip service, and we talk about all these things that's going on in the community, and yet little things like this. I had to get a phone call from Legal Aid saying this is not doing enough, so I would appreciate it.
Yeah, sir, Representative, thank you. And would you come to that meeting as well? Can we make it time for you to be there as well? Yeah, let's do it. Great, thank you for that.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the incentives under the Innovation Collaborative, you mentioned the entrepreneur benefits package, where $7,500 would be spent on health benefits for the startup business. I guess it would be the owner of the startup business. I'm just wondering about the conditions to receive that benefit package, which I think is a good idea, but just an observation on this. To receive that benefit package, I would think it would be a good idea to have that person have part of his or her business plan to provide benefits for their employees as well. So if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. Are there such conditions in place that I just described, and do you think there ought to be?
Mr. Representative, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you raised it. When thinking about this incentive package, we're thinking about like the one or two people that are starting a company. This is like the very first step, and so we hadn't thought about putting sort of more qualifications on what they might eventually do once their startup is created in terms of benefits packages. I'd be interested to discuss that. I think most startups are just that's so far in the future. They're just thinking about how to even survive and get the thing started. But I think it's a great point. And hopefully, I would say at the very least, having received this help from the government, you think that they would sort of understand the benefits of it. But I think we should talk about it. Maybe there's a way we can refine this a little bit to include that. I think, you know, the goal here is that, again, to sort of de-risk this a little bit, or at least lower the risk for entrepreneurs who wouldn't otherwise start it. That particular package, by the way, you talk to the startup community, it kind of puts a light in their eyes, because there's so many folks who need that little extra nudge to start something. And so we believe in, like, tailoring these programs to fit the need of the community we're trying to serve, and this is one of those cases where it just hits the bullseye, we think, of what that community really needs to start. Thanks for the comment.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
We have two more people on, and I have one raging question. So would you prefer to kind of keep your comments short, Representative Haley and Representative Koznick, or should I just go right ahead and make his life uncomfortable?
I'm happy to watch you work.
Representative Haley?
Okay, I'll take the other answer. Can I be very short, Mr. Chair?
Very short.
I just bought you some time.
All right.
I was just at a child care conference this week in my district.
Oh.
My district alone has a shortage of 630 spots. So I appreciate that part of your proposal. One question, is the money dedicated to centers or also to in-home?
I believe it's both.
It's both,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And again, comment, I would ask you, and I know this isn't your area indeed, but look at the regulations. That's the number one thing.
Yep.
I heard back from 50
yep.
people in the room. They are eager, and we're working on community collaboratives across my district
mm-hmm.
to have both increase in-home and center-based with other nonprofits. But the regulations are what are stopping people and what are causing people to leave. So the grants are great, but we need to work out the other side of the equation as well. Thank you
for that.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Yep. My pleasure, Representative Haley, and I'll look forward to the bill that you put forward that gets rid of regulations that protect children. Commissioner, I have one question about the Angel Investment Tax Credit. The two members of this committee were kind of its doulas.
Mm-hmm.
We both still have the scars on our back from that particular fight.
Thank you for that. I mean, for making it happen, not for the scars.
One of my huge complaint.
Uh-huh.
The Angel Investment Tax Credit serves almost exclusively, but not 100%, the western Hennepin County first and second and third ring suburbs, and the rest of the state barely gets the crumbs. I don't know if it's the high buck value investors that don't want to drive their vehicles beyond a certain point. They get cold sweats, they mm-hmm. whatever, they can't see the map, or there's a snowstorm or something. But maybe one of the things that might entice that is, rather than on your, I think it was, you said it was $5,000 was the lower limit for?
$7,500.
Why don't you make it like $2,500, make it $10,000 for those, the Golden Crescent, as I like to call it,
mm-hmm.
and maybe $2,500 for the rest of the state. So then maybe, because of the greed that those angel investors have, because I'm going to call it what it is, might actually get in their car and drive and go look at something in Representative Gunther's district or Representative Eklund's district. Because I'm frankly very tired, and I was very happy to see the Angel Investment Tax Credit go away last year for the very simple reason that the rest of the state did not benefit from that program. But a lot of wealthy people
mm-hmm.
benefited from that program. Why don't you rethink your idea about how you bring that down to people?
Yeah.
I don't have $10,000 to dump into an angel investment. I might have $2,500 to put into my brother's thing if he ever crazy enough to start his own business.
Uh-huh.
I looked into that one time and realized that I could be home by 4 o'clock and playing with my kids, or I could still be at the office at 10 o'clock.
Right.
I made the choice in one thing. So
yep.
That's my comment. If you would care to respond to that, that's fine.
Sure.
But I'm that angel investment tax credit is coming to this particular committee.
Mr. Chair, thanks for that. And I think you know that anyone, the wisdom of this program, given you were one of its key proponents over the past 6 or 7 years, I would say this. Let's discuss it. I think, you know, what we want to make sure we get right is making that investment level significant enough such that it actually helps a company get off the ground. If you make it too low, it's like, well, then is it even enough money to really incentivize getting a company started? And so, but we're not wedded to 7,500. If we want to make it lower, that makes sense. I think the only other thing, and so let's discuss that. The other thing I would say is part of the beauty of this Minnesota Innovation Collaborative is that we are trying to focus on startups outside of the metro area and startups from targeted communities. Those communities, it's not just capital they need. They need sort of basic idea of how to get started. And obviously metro areas across this country are the startup hotbeds of any individual state. That's sort of just a network effect of the reality of how the startup communities work. But you talk to the guys up in St. Cloud, where I was last week, who run Great North Labs. They built, you know, Ryan and Rob Weber, they built a multi-million dollar company that they were able to sell called NativeX in St. Cloud. And they're now helping greater Minnesota startups do that as well. So we've been consulting with them, other startups and venture capitalists outside of metro area, and how we can make these programs better work for startups who aren't in the Twin Cities. And I think it's part investment, and then it's part also sort of education and network support so that you can understand the pathway that it would take to create a company. But I completely agree with the spirit of what you've said and would love to dig into the numbers on it to make sure we get that number right so that we can move this outside of the Twin Cities.
Representative Kosnick, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion on the opportunity gap, and it's something that I've become more aware of, more in the education achievement gap. But I'm kind of taking a look at this, and, you know, it sounds good, and I think we need to do it. And you'd mentioned some new metrics to measure success, and I was just wondering if you could share a couple examples, because sometimes I recognize the problem, but I kind of want to shy away from kind of identity politics sometimes. But also, rather than just feeling good about putting it as a mark in the budget, you know, how are we going to measure that we've actually achieved success and are making progress? Because, you know, I appreciate the demographics that are listed in here. I think they kind of speak for themselves that it's an important issue. But
yeah, it's a great question, Chairman, Representative. I think we've got some work to do on developing those metrics, and would love your advice on that. I would say that in the first round of equity grants, we did see, you know, almost 80% of the participants were from communities of color. Almost 20% had a criminal history. So this is definitely targeting sectors of our labor market that need the most help. The metrics we saw that we were encouraged by in that first round were primarily around wage gains. So it wasn't just the number of people that were employed after the equity grants went into effect, but it was where their wages went. And if you look at wage for people of color, the American Indian population, which of course faces some of the steepest challenges, their median wages went up by $2 or $3 after being a part of these programs. And so we don't just want to get more jobs, we want to get better jobs and more livable wages and higher wages. And so I would say it's a combination of metrics around, you know, wage increases, percent employment. We want to look more at full-time employment versus just part-time employment. Obviously, a full-time job is more than twice as good as a part-time job because of the benefits that come with that. So we really want to work towards people getting full-time jobs coming out of these programs. But I would say it's a priority for me and my team to look at this set of grants, and as we get closer to making this next wave a possibility, or reality rather, create the right metrics for success. The last thing I would say is this, that, you know, when you talk to members of this community, and I talked to a lot of the grantees in my first month here who got money in that first series of equity grants, they'll tell you that while standardized metrics are helpful because, of course, you got to show you're using the grant money effective, for a lot of these communities, there's sort of different solutions for different communities. And so one of the things that we want to balance here is having some sort of common sense metrics for success while also understanding that a program for the American Indian community might look different than a program for the Somali community, might look different than a program for greater Minnesota. And so it's my job as your commissioner to figure that out and get the right things in place such that I can come back to you when we're done and say with confidence these things worked and here's why, or they didn't work and here's why, but also that we weren't so inflexible that we didn't find ways to be nimble for different communities in terms of what they need. So that's the trick in this. And I think, you know, we're committed to getting that right and would love your suggestions and thoughts as we build this out.
Any further questions? No. Okay. Are there any other questions? We are at our half hour of pain and suffering. Glad you could sit through it. Members, if you have questions for the commissioner, he's not going to give out his cell number, I don't think, like the governor does, but his office will respond. Deed has, in all the years that I've sat on this committee, when I've made a phone call, they've gotten back to me. Maybe not the commissioner, but somebody who can answer a question. So feel free to give them a call. You have an election certificate. They work for you. They work for the governor, but they answer to you. And you get to set their budget. And they are not stupid people. If they don't answer our questions, their budget gets harmed at the end of the day. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Chair.
And I look forward to further conversations about how we fix this, some of the problems we've developed and how we put together new programs that help entrepreneurs, help workers, and everybody in the state.
Me too. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Have a great day.
Next on the agenda is the Department of Commerce. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Kelly.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm supposed to use first names here, so at least introducing you.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to present the Commerce Department proposed budget changes. My name is Steve Kelly, and I am the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. I will do a brief overview of the governor. Actually, I'm going to skip the governor's proposals because Commissioner Grove covered the overall budget perspective that are in the first few slides that you had. And I will also acknowledge, since our time is tight, that I've given you a Commerce Department overview previously. The teacher and me would love to do repetition, but I am not sure that that is necessary this morning. But I will say that the Commerce Department does work with a range of industries and works with 350,000 Minnesotans who are licensed through the department, and that our budget proposal relates to our ability to work effectively with them. You also have a slide showing the department's leadership team, and I am going to go right to our budget change items. So the first budget change item I will talk about is our agency operating budget. The governor recommends $1,332,000 in fiscal year 2020 and $1,604,000 in ongoing funding in the following year to support the core functions of the Department of Commerce. As I probably mentioned in my previous appearance with this committee, the Department of Commerce was the only operating agency that did not receive a budget increase in the previous biennium, and so this proposed adjustment just actually gets us caught up. It doesn't really make up for the lost ground from the previous 2 years. And what we will primarily do with this money, we're going to pay increases in rent in our building. We're going to be trying to fill open positions, particularly in enforcement and in areas of the department that work with the public, and address prospective raises and benefit increases over the coming biennium. The next recommendation is for $416,000 in each of fiscal 20, 21, and 22 to support the Commerce IT system modernization project. We have a number of outdated programs that are no longer supported, and we need to invest this money in order to develop new systems that will enable us to work more effectively. For example, the department works with the Public Utilities Commission, and the e-dockets system is used to review the official record of utility regulation and is open to the public. And improving that system would not only improve agency operations, but would also improve public access to information. Similarly, the e-filing system allows users to upload documents as part of regulatory proceedings. There are 3,700 active users of that program, and 17,000 documents were e-filed in fiscal year 2018. Making sure that that system works effectively is critical to the department. There's also an e-assessment system that enables utilities to pay the department assessments online instead of mailing checks. So we think that these system improvements will improve security, but also improve public access and public awareness of the work that is done on their behalf. The next request is for $250,000 a year in 20 and 21 to continue the senior financial fraud prevention program that the legislature funded in the current fiscal year. We have expended all of the resources that were provided to us and found that it was successful in reaching numerous citizens around the state. We held outreach meetings and developed a hang-up on fraud packet and engaged in outreach at the State Fair and other locations in order to alert Minnesotans, both seniors and their family members, about the high level of risks that the increasing number of seniors are facing from financial fraud. The estimates are at a national level that between $2.9 billion and $36-some billion are lost as a result of elder financial abuse in the United States. And only one of every 44 cases of financial abuse is ever reported. We've been successful in working with financial institutions, particularly financial advisors and brokers, in identifying seniors who may be victims of abuse, and we want to continue that work. We also want to translate our program to additional languages so that we reach other communities, not just those that speak English. We also deal with the state's unclaimed property system, and so we're proposing modernization and a cybersecurity upgrade in the IT system that supports the unclaimed property program. So we're recommending $475,000 in fiscal 20 and $350,000 per year. The $475,000 is essentially the customization of an existing of an available program to Minnesota's unclaimed property system, and the $350,000 is the ongoing maintenance and licensing of that program. We want to make sure that that system is secure because applicants for return of unclaimed property put in significant amounts of personal data that needs to be protected. In addition to the system change, we're proposing a modernization of the unclaimed property law and related operational changes, and so the governor is recommending $368,000 in fiscal 20 and $702,000 in the three subsequent years to modernize the unclaimed property program and related statutes. The additional operating costs actually come from personnel increases that would be needed to carry out the operation of the expanded program. We think modernization would bring in additional property to the system As I might have mentioned previously, the legislation hasn't been amended in some 20 years, and a number of changes have occurred in the marketplace since then, including the development of instruments like gift cards in place of what used to be gift certificates, things like that that we have to recognize as part of the new program. We also, you know, as I was reading through the proposed law changes, we also have to find ways to exclude the kind of property that has been developed in the video gaming space, because we don't want to capture the kinds of value that exists in those games for redeeming in-game activities. So we have to be careful as we do this modernization, to be careful not to include some things that simply weren't on the radar screen 20 years ago. But we do think that we will bring additional property back to Minnesotans. Our estimates are that we will return an additional $16.5 million in fiscal 21 to Minnesotans, and also an additional $30 million in property transferred to the state and held for Minnesotans who may seek their unclaimed property. The next proposal relates to the Minnesota Premium Security Fund. The governor is recommending transferring approximately $281.4 million that is currently in the Premium Security Plan account in fiscal 2021 to the Health Care Access Fund to support programs to increase access to affordable health insurance coverage and health care services. The Premium Security Plan was created in 2017 to provide reinsurance payments to health insurers. The cost of that program has been somewhat lower than expected, and we were able to use a significant contribution of federal funds to cover the cost of that program. So there is a balance of roughly $281 million that can be returned to the Health Care Access Fund. This change item supports the governor's budget proposal to increase access to affordable health insurance coverage and health care services. Finally, the department has been involved in a couple litigation matters that have resulted in adverse results. One was a lawsuit started by the state of North Dakota against Minnesota related to the Next Generation Energy Act, passed by the legislature in 2007. The full amount of the attorney's fees that the state is obligated to pay are $960,000. Half of that is in this budget change item. The other half is being carried in the Public Utilities Commission related request. And then in 2015, the SafeLight Group sued the Department of Commerce, arguing that we had unconstitutionally entered into a consent order with an insurance company dealing with auto glass replacement, and the district court reached a mixed ruling, including finding against Commerce on a portion of the SafeLight claims, and did order the Commerce Department to pay attorney's fees and costs, but the amount of that is still significant, $960,000. So those, Mr. Chairman and members, are the change items relevant to this committee's jurisdiction that the governor is recommending, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the members? I'll start, because then everybody will just jump in, and you get your ration of torture. On the unclaimed property, does the state hold on to that property forever, or does it absorb it into the state general fund at a certain point?
Mr. Chairman, members, the state takes the unclaimed property into the general fund and holds it until we receive a claim from an owner who can verify their ownership interest, and then we pay it out to that Minnesotan. So it is when we obtain it from the private holder, whether it's a bank or other entity, it is taken into the general fund, and then payments are made out of the general fund to the legitimate owner of the property.
And Mr. Commissioner, you only take in the unclaimed property. It's only some kind of cash or financial piece. It's not grandma's golden ring or Tom's Ferrari, grandpa's Ferrari that he kept in the garage and no one knew about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the Ferrari, but
you don't have one back. Your grandpa did.
But the but we do take physical property often that is included in safe deposit boxes or other kinds of safekeeping, and so we have, for example, have started in doing online auctions for property that we've held a certain period of time, and we then hold the cash from that auction for the beneficial owner of that property.
Just so you, the Ferrari piece came from Grandma's 1952 Ford that everybody forgot was in the barn that she kept in the back of her house in, you know, in Morton, and only needed a paint job and new tires in order to be called a mint. So, are there any other questions? Any other questions? Okay. Typically, I'll ask one other question, and typically does this committee have these litigation expenses? Because this is, you know, in my multiple years here, I don't know that I've ever noticed or knew that we put litigation expenses into your budget. And what happens if we does this 100 or 1.5 million just roll over to the next biennium if we say no, we're not going to pay that?
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't know that it could roll over to the next biennium. We have entered it, for example, on the $960,000, we've entered into a payment agreement with SafeLight so that the there isn't additional interest or an accumulation of costs related to that $960,000. So if the legislature did not appropriate that money, we would have to take it out of some other part of our budget on a one-time basis and absorb that through personnel changes.
So, Mr. Commissioner, the Commerce Department has just entered into litigation over the Enbridge Pipeline 3. Is that coming out of this budget here, or does that come out of the fiscal, the energy budget?
Mr. Chairman and members, the staffing that engages in the review of the filings is in the department's operating budget, and so an increase in our operating budget could affect the staffing in the energy resources area, just as it could in the insurance, banking, or enforcement area. So I think it's fair to say that the operating budget covers the whole range. The litigation and our general counsel's costs are included in those operating expenses, and then to the extent that we're represented by the Attorney General's office, the attorney time related to that would be included in the Attorney General's budget.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, No further questions? Thank you, Commissioner Kelly.
Mr. Chairman and members, we would appreciate your support of these requests.
You have a few building trades people on, so you might have some issues there. Members, is there any more business before the committee? I will once again reiterate if you care to have your bill or any of the bonding bills heard in the committee, you should tell me. Otherwise, we will by memo most likely just move all those over to the Capital Investment Committee. Friday, the bus leaves at 10. Please, for the St. Cloud hearing on child care. It's a combined, and we've got a couple bills coming that will deal with child care and child care centers. Please contact Travis and let him know that you're going to be waiting for the bus. And I expect it to be back 4 o'clock, 4:30, depending on the snow. With that, we are adjourned.